on a Tuesday. This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolf-Manera. Hello, Cherry.
Hello, Avi. Listeners, right here on Studio 2, well, we've heard from every viable candidate in the Democratic primary for the next mayor of Philadelphia. Former city council member at large, David O, is the sole Republican running in his party's primary, and he's here today to talk about his vision for the city and why he's the best person to run it. Talk to him later.
And the primary election is drawing near, Cherry. It's 1 week.
I can't believe it.
Today.
Countdown.
Time flies. Later in the show, we're also going to talk about the pros and cons of a four-day work week. More companies are thinking about it. Then we explore the intersection of social media and puberty.
Yeah, looking forward to that. But first, some information that was possibly cleared up from last week, Avi. You remember the story about the mounds of pasta found in a creek in Old Bridge, New Jersey.
How could I forget?
How could you forget those photos? Well, some neighbors think they have solved the mystery around who dumped it. And let me tell you what they found. Neighbors believe a man who was cleaning out his parents' home, who stockpiled the dried pasta. They believe he dumped the dried pasta, which got rained on, and it just looked cooked in the pictures.
Because of the rain.
He did it allegedly because Old Bridge has no bulk garbage pickup. But people kept asking, why didn't you just donate the pasta? Why would you open the boxes up and somehow dump them somewhere and then put them in a creek? It just didn't make sense to me.
It's not adding up to you, Cherry. I could tell.
I smell something funny there.
This has, it's sort of a funny story, right? But it has, you know, highlighted this larger issue of illegal dumping. And it just so happens that Delaware is now dealing with a different problem, far less splashy and viral, but there are 10,000 tons of illegal tires, old tires dumped on a piece of state-owned land at the Port of Wilmington that's being leased to a different company based out of the Middle East. We don't have time to get into all the details of that. But suffice it to say, here in Philadelphia, around the region, illegal dumping is a huge problem. And we can laugh about the pasta thing, but it's often a sign that government's not working in some way.
Yeah, and people are getting bolder with it. I mean, the pasta looked crazy, and now you got tires. I mean, somebody should have seen something. Yeah.
Speaking of the way government runs, in South Jersey, it has often run through a man named George Norcross, who was a Democratic Party power broker. But he said in an interview with Politico yesterday, he is stepping back from politics. This is a seismic shift in South Jersey politics. If you don't know George Norcross, he's an interesting figure because he's never held public office, and yet he has created one of the most powerful Democratic machines in the country, wields enormous influence. It's weird to say behind the scenes. It's very much really in front of the scenes. Everyone knows that he runs this political machine. He says he's pulling back because of some recent defeats, including a high-profile one. One of his proteges, State Senate President Steve Sweeney, lost in the last election to a political unknown, a truck driver named Ed Durr Jr. And so basically Norcross said, the writing's on the wall, time for me to get out of here.
Yeah, he's going to let younger people lead the party. And that was a big upset, that race.
Yep.
A lot of egg on the face of Norcross there. But he said that he would come out a semi-retirement if Sweeney decided to take a run for governor.
It may be a topic for another day, but Norcross, for better or for worse, has completely reshaped the city of Camden.
Did.
He was a wheeler and a dealer. He wasn't really an ideologue. He worked with Chris Christie a lot, for instance, who's a Republican. And from the police department to the Cooper University Hospital system to the remaking of the city school system, I mean, Norcross had his hands in all of it, and now he's gone.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens. Back over the bridge to Philadelphia, we're talking about prisons. Two inmates broke out of Philadelphia prisons over the weekend, demonstrating a major breakdown of processes within the city jails. I mean, the suspects on the run include 18-year-old Amin Hurst, who is charged with four homicides, and 24-year-old Nasir Grant, who is facing drug and gun charges. Apparently, they escaped from the Philadelphia Industrial Correctional Center in Holmesburg on Sunday at 8:30 p.m. But get this, Avi, their absence was not noticed until Monday afternoon. That's according to Prisons Commissioner Blanche Carney. She says the suspects escaped through a fence in the prison yard. Now, all of this comes as the commissioner is under fire. Just last week, the Correctional Officers Union entered a vote of no confidence in her leadership, saying she failed to adequately respond respond to a staffing crisis. I should mention that the prisons have more than 800 vacancies here in Philadelphia.
Yeah, and basically no one understands how this wasn't caught for so long, because there are supposed to be regular mm-hmm. checks of you know, who's in the prison and who's not in the prison. So a lot to be unraveled here. We really don't know the important details, but plenty of questions.
For sure. And Mayor Kenney says he's angry about it, and he's asking the State Department of Correction to come in and do an investigation. So we'll hear a lot more about this.
Speaking of questions, we've got some for a mayoral Absolutely. Candidate. Now, this is the last in our series of interviews talking to all the mayoral candidates here in Philadelphia. In about 162 hours, May 16th, 7 a.m., polling places will open in Philadelphia. And today we have Republican candidate and former city council member at large, David O, in Studio 2 to talk about his agenda. David, welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
I want to start here. Give me one thing that you would do as mayor that none of the Democrats have proposed.
Well, I think probably the most obvious thing for me is to deal with our very inequitable, unconstitutional school district. And what they have not proposed is really a systemic change, which I would do, number one. I did it as a council person to change the governance structure. I believe the city should be divided into five zones. And there, each zone, the residents will elect a school board representative to be responsive to that. To them, and in that sense, create a greater level of transparency and therefore accountability. Those five members would run the entire school board, of course, along with the four that the mayor would appoint. But one of the problems that we have is after so many decades of talking about equity in the schools, it does not happen. And I think people are tired of hearing about equity in the schools when it is required by the Constitution. It is obviously something that every child deserves, and yet it never happens.
Yeah. One of the things that I heard you say would be a part of your campaign is transparency and accountability, specifically when it comes to taxpayer dollars. And you referenced COVID relief money and soda tax revenue. What do you think you would do differently? And what are some of the red flags that you've seen that has said, you know what, we need more transparency, we need more accountability when it comes to these two expenditures specifically?
Well, I think the reason there's a problem, and it's related to almost every topic you talk about the prisons just now. Because there is a lack of transparency, people don't actually know how much money is spent, where it's being spent, why it's not being spent. They should know, and therefore they would have a more accurate expectation of what their government is supposed to do. I run into so many people who say, "Yeah, I'm overtaxed, and it's really hurting me. But our city's broke, so I feel like they need the money." I tell them the city's not broke; it's just mismanaged. You know, the idea that you see potholes and cracked sidewalks and trash everywhere, you think the city's broke. I mean, you read about it. It's poorly managed, is what it is, and it will have a lot of consequences. But year after year, it spends money like it's not broke. And the money disappears. And where does it go? It's not just the issue that the resources are disappearing. The issue is what they're supposed to do doesn't get done. And when it doesn't get done, the culprits who are involved get away with it, and they go on to come back to our city time and time again. For example, we were talking about what happened to COVID money. I can't find out as a council member because I couldn't get a bill passed. I couldn't get a resolution passed. Therefore, I cannot by myself investigate that. But okay, the money's gone. That's a big problem in and of itself. But where's the consequences? How did that begin with? And will that happen again? When we talk about the schools, you know, okay, the inequity in the schools are because of what? People imagine it's because there's poverty in the schools, because the schools don't have enough money. They couldn't possibly deal with these issues. And yet they do have the money. And we have asbestos again and again. It's supposed to be resolved. The resolution is given to us in great detail. In the 1990s, there was how much money spent. There was hazmat suits, 20-pound bags, all very carefully done. It was not talking about encasing the asbestos in some chemicals. It was talking about the removal, and yet we're still talking about it. So when it comes to the performance of government, we have to know in greater detail what it is doing and what it is not doing, and we shouldn't give a pass to government. So many of the problems in Philadelphia originate from government failure.
Mm-hmm. So, but can you be a little more specific, though, because you talk about the COVID money or you talk about the schools. I hear a lot, and you're not the only person running for mayor who says the problem is efficiency, the problem is mismanagement. But then you try to get into the details of like, well, what's the specific red flag? Like what, or what is the specific thing that you would fix? And then oftentimes you just don't get a lot in terms of detail back. Like, give me some detail.
Sure. Well, for example, when COVID first broke out, the mayor said, and I agree with what the mayor said, he said, COVID is unpredictable. We've never had this. I need basically a blank check. And he got tens of million dollars, and I voted for it because we didn't know if we were going to have to, you know, reopen some facility like Hahnemann Hospital or the Convention Center, buy respirators. We wanted to the mayor to be able to act in a second's notice. But also there was an emergency which then changed the checks and balances of our government, whereby city council no longer had certain abilities with the mayor, and the mayor could do things on his own. One of the things that happened is after his second request for another amounts of tens of millions of dollars, we never saw those respirators. We never saw the use of that money. We were talking about, you know, vaccines that were not going to be paid for by the city of Philadelphia, and then the failure to distribute them, particularly in African-American communities, where we read time and time again how black physicians were denied, and yet sitting on the commission with Dr. Farley, the health commissioner, was a very young person from Drexel University, had no background in this other than he once did a kind of like a vaccine distribution.
Okay.
The mystery is what happened to that. Now, here's where we differentiate, because I did a bill. I did a bill, and I tried to pass the bill to hold Dr. Farley accountable, to see where the money went, to have him come before council as required under the charter to get our approval for an extension of his emergency powers. But that was defeated. So for all those council members who voted against it, that's the difference of not trying to find
out. We are running out of time. I want to get one more question.
Yeah, and so David, I got to ask you this. I mean, you're running unopposed in this Republican primary. And so you'll make it to the general, but it's been more than 20 years since a Republican even came close.
Yes, I wasn't around 20 years ago, so I can't explain
and
that.
Seven decades since a Republican ran City Hall. Yes. Why do you think you're the GOP candidate that's going to do it here in Philadelphia?
We have about 45 seconds.
Yeah, I think because Democrats, along with everybody else, want something better. And they're tired of the same rhetoric about solutions that never happen. I think the bigger problem is the collusion and complacency, and they want someone who is not connected to all of that, who not only talks about that but has done things where they have distinguished themselves in their willingness to break down the walls of complacency and corruption in this city.
Well, there you have it. That is the end, by the way, of our entire series of interviews with mayoral candidates. The last person joining us is David O., the sole Republican running for mayor here in Philadelphia. David O., thanks for joining us right here on Studio 2.
Yeah, thank you very much.
We appreciate you being here. So coming up next on Studio 2, Avi, the four-day work week.
The four-day work
week. It sounds so good. We want to know if you could get your job done in fewer days and if you think it's a good idea. Call us 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. Avi, I wouldn't mind every Friday off. I don't know.
I'm putting my hand up right now. We'll investigate coming up on Studio 2. Stick with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, five-day-a-week worker.
Yes, I am too.
Let's talk about work now, Cherry. Imagine if our boss, we have the same boss, told us that we could work 4 days a week instead of five for the same pay, 32 hours instead of 40. What would you think?
I'd say, I'll take it. But at the same time, I'd be very skeptical.
Yeah, I would too.
It sounds way too good to be true. There has to be a catch. That's what my, like, the other side of my brain would tell me. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, maybe there is a catch. We're going to dive in. The idea of a four-day work week does appear to be gaining momentum. There are a few bills in Harrisburg to study it. There's a new bill in Congress. And the results just came back from a big study over in the UK of 61 businesses who tried the concept. Workers reported less stress and burnout. The businesses found no change in revenues or productivity, plus far less employee turnover.
So we're going to dig into this idea of the four-day work week. Is it really feasible or just a pie in the sky idea? Lonnie Golden, a professor of economics and labor human resources at Penn State Abington, joins us in our studio to explain how it works, how companies are compressing work to 4 days without losing money, and if it's likely to come to your workplace. Welcome, Lonnie.
Great to be here.
We packed a lot on you there.
So, yeah, we have to unpack some stuff here, Lonnie. So, four-day work week, in some ways, I'm actually confused by what people even mean when they say four-day work week, because you could be talking about 4 days, but 40 hours packed into those 4 days. You could be talking about 32 hours. You could be talking about the same amount of pay. You could be talking about less pay. Have we actually coalesced yet around an idea of what four-day work week even means?
Not yet, but it's a really good point that you bring up, which is we've had a history of a five-day work week, and the four-day option was 4x10, and this new discussion that's both national, organizational, and of course now individual is about a 4x8, right? So, and maybe there's room in between at a 4x9. Maybe that's where we wind up landing. We don't know yet. But it's so interesting that all this discussion is occurring at the country national level, organizational level, companies and not-for-profits, and at the individual level.
It's all happening all at once.
Right. Yeah. And they're all aligned.
Yep.
And I just want to remind our listeners that we want to hear from you. Are you in favor of a four-day work week? Could you get your job done in 32 hours? The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email us at studio2@whyy.org. And we're also going to hear from a state rep about bills in Harrisburg. But I want to dig in a little bit, because what has sort of led to this momentum where now, like, the 5 days doesn't work anymore? We need to change the structure of work.
I think there's been experiments with the length of the work week in different countries, different industries, different time periods. But it's coalescing now because we went from this labor surplus type of job market, where I've been studying part-time work and a lot of people wanted to work more. And suddenly we flipped over to this labor shortage and people are reconsidering whether they want to keep working as much.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing that in some of the surveys I'm issuing for a grant from the Urban Institute with my co-authors, Jason Kim and Stuart Glosser.
Put that plug in, Lonnie.
And we are finding it's pretty interesting that there's this desire for relatively shorter work time, that this people are at the individual level are entertaining the part-time option. And some of that might be, you know, shorter hours every day or shorter hours for the week, but people are also entertaining this idea of reconfiguring their work week.
So you
because
think
I think under with the pandemic, a lot of people were forced to be at home or spending leisure time and said, well, that was maybe too much, you know, too much time with the family or not being able to go to the office, but they don't want to adjust fully back.
Yeah.
And we're seeing in these surveys that the support for the four-day work week idea is tremendously high, like 70-some percent, very little against it.
So driven perhaps by some macroeconomic trends, the power being in the hands of workers a bit right now, what are the supposed theoretical benefits of a four-day work week? And I'm not asking you to parse the data, but why do even people want to consider this?
Well, I think people want to consider it at the individual level because of their well-being effects. And that's what this famous study now of 61 companies in the UK have found, that the well-being effects like health and work-family balance, lower stress, that's clear. But what we're also finding in that study in particular, which is that organizations didn't experience any downside, really. And in the end of the 60 companies, 90% want to continue with it and 50% just made it permanent. They're not going back. Mm. So they must be experiencing much less negative outcome than they expected. There were some companies that didn't, you know, go all the way through the study, but and it was there was some selectivity in which companies participated, but they did a good job of designing the experiments so there would be companies represented in a wide range of industries. But I think there's this alignment that nothing really bad happened. Even with that 180-100 where they were paying people 100% to work 80% of the time.
And I want to dig into how could you be more, like I'm thinking about work. So you take, you lob off a day or 8 hours of your work week, but you're getting the exact same amount of work done. How does that, is that,
sounds,
how
seems
people,
like magic.
It seems like, yeah, it's like, how are you able to pack in 40 hours of work in 32 hours?
Well, it's not possible for everybody or for every kind of company or for every industry. There's an old standard trade joke in economics where the free market economists at University of Chicago are walking down the quad and one of them says, hey, look, there's a $100 bill laying on the ground. And the other ones don't even bother looking. They say, that's impossible. Don't be silly. If there was a $100 bill laying on the ground, somebody would have picked it up already, right? So if there was an opportunity to maximize efficiency by having a four-day work week, companies, individuals, and governments would have been doing this already. So the point is, when sort of pushed by this external force of the pandemic and this adjustment and not wanting to readjust all the way back, will they find that, huh, maybe there is like a $20 bill laying on the ground and maybe I should pay attention to that because there are some efficiencies that maybe organizations or individuals like you were emphasizing haven't yet taken advantage of. So at the individual level, you could say there's this notion that, well, if I'm going to get Fridays off and I'm working for this company, I better get everything done by Thursday afternoon. And maybe some sort of reciprocity that I appreciate my employer not having me work for the next 3 days, and I'll make sure I get my work done. And so there's these little efficiencies that, and focus and reducing downtime and taking advantage of technology that is there that maybe wasn't being applied fully, where people get re-energized or refocused to squeeze out a little bit of that inefficiency or downtime that had existed.
Let me put my skeptic's hat on, though. How do we control for the possibility that this is just being driven by novelty? Because most people don't work a four-day work week. And so perhaps these reports of higher satisfaction among workers, the fact that they're being more productive in the hours that they are working, is it possible that's a short-term boost and something that would dissipate if this was more widespread and this was the standard?
That's a really good point. We don't know yet what the long-term or sustainability of this would be. So we are finding with that one particular experiment or others that you're getting a lot of subtle effects. So one of the things that came out of that study that to me was really impressive was that 50% reported improved job satisfaction. Not surprisingly, 75% reported improved life satisfaction. So you get both of that, people being more satisfied with their jobs. So in turn, they're probably less likely to quit, less likely to have their morale drop, less likely to engage in that sort of unproductive time, at least too much, you know, spending time on personal business while at work. Nobody does that out there, right?
Absolutely not.
So when you're sort of faced with that prospect of, well, I want to stay in this job and I'm happy with this job, and no matter what the margin, there are these little ways in which maybe this is sustainable over the longer term.
And I want to bring in now someone else to the conversation. We have Pennsylvania State Representative Chris Rabb, who represents parts of North and Northwest Philadelphia. He introduced legislation last year calling for the Commonwealth to study the efficacy of a four-day work week for state employees. There's also a bill right now to incentivize private companies. Chris, you're in studio too.
Hi.
How you doing?
Yeah, I want to. Well, thank you.
Yes, thank you for being here. So I want to ask you, why do you think the four-day work week would be good for Pennsylvania?
Well, it's not so much about whether I think it'll be good. We need to know. So we need the data. We need to research it. And one of the benefits of legislation that allows us to put forth resolutions, some of those resolutions call for commissioning studies so that our research arms of the legislature can do what they're set up to do, paid for by taxpayers, to actually not make assumptions or pretend that we know all the answers and dig around and see what works. Now, you had the esteemed professor talking, who I've spoken to as well and appreciate. We want to make sure that the people who are on the cutting edge of this, who have studied this for years, for decades, are on the front end before we actually introduce legislation to say, oh, well, this is a fad. My constituents and voters will love it, so I'm just going to do it. No, you can also put forth legislation that requires a study so that it will inform substantive policy towards doing what's good for workers, employers, and society at large. And so that's what I've put forth. My legislation is actually a resolution and not a bill. So what it would seek to do is to determine what subset of state workers could benefit from not just a four-day work week, but a flexible work schedule that could include teleworking, which we know quite a bit about, having gone through a pandemic. Mm-hmm. So it's essentially a way to figure out what the future of work is with state employees first. But my resolution also will allow for this legislative research arm to look at a pilot project that can involve state contractors. And state contractors could be small, medium, large scale corporations that do work with the state. So and see if their to see if their employees could benefit from this too. So it'd be a voluntary
Representative Rabb, we don't have a ton of time, but I want to imagine a world where you do get this passed or able to study this with some state employees, some state contractors. What would success look like for you? For instance, let's imagine that employees love it, but the state has to hire more of them and that costs the state money. Would that be a success for you? Try to define for me what success would look like for a pilot project.
Well, the resolution would not create a pilot project, but would provide recommendations for one should it be put forth. And my colleagues who we referenced before are introduced a bill to create a pilot project. So mine actually would come before that. So success for this resolution would be that the Legislative Budget and Finance Committee does its due diligence, talk to experts, like the professor and others and other state agency directors and workers, to show that there is indeed ways that we can save money, reduce our carbon footprint, improve work-life balance, and provide good services to Pennsylvanians, and that can be codified and documented in a report that is accessible to everyone, such that it can lead to me introducing legislation to make it happen.
Well, all right. Well, thank you so much. That was Pennsylvania State Representative Chris Rabb. Thank you for being on Studio 2.
My pleasure.
And we want to hear from you, our listeners. Are you in favor of a four-day work week? Could you get the job done in 32 hours? Our number is 888-477-9499. You can also email us at studio2@whyy.org. We still have with us Lonnie Golden, Professor of Economics and Labor Human Resources at Penn State Abington. I want to go back to you, Lonnie, and just sort of talk about, could some inequities come out of this? Because I'm putting my skeptic's hat on now, and I'm thinking that some jobs you could reduce to 4 days and still get the work done, but some other jobs require that you actually be somewhere and that a company might have to hire more people, as Avi mentioned, in order to adequately provide services. Would it sort of create this class structure among types of workers and types of work if we were to shift the structure?
Well, there already is a lot of class structure there already. So if you're saying maybe it would worsen it, that's possible. I wouldn't say that that's likely because it's an opt-in type of program. So a company that says we can't really reconfigure our work week like that, we're going to forego this opportunity for tax credits or whatever because maybe we'll give it a try for a year and see how it goes. But that is possible. I don't think that that we can address the issue of occupational segregation, you know, with this. Maybe we could do something to the bill that says that tax credits are bigger in the industries where there's occupational segregation to entice people, to entice the companies to do that, to entice them to think about how to reconfigure work so that it does not have an inequitable impact on people individually or by group. I think I wanted to add to the representative that Pennsylvania is one of several states now that are proposing mm-hmm. this, and some are pretty far along with it, like Maryland. And they're thinking this through. And one of the interesting things that came out of the feedback of why they didn't pass the bill was that employers were saying they were not as sensitive to or enticed by the tax break mm-hmm. against their state income tax as they wanted, like, guidance on how to do that. So there's this receptivity among the employers. And in that UK experiment, what worked, what helped it work well was they had like 2 months to before adopting it to have the voice of their employees mm-hmm. and some input to say, here's what you could do and rearrange so that this could succeed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's at that point where they could get the employees to say, hey, what about me? Or why are you not including my job in this? So if it's done right, you can get that win-win with no decline in overall productivity with the increases in well-being because people are able to get more time away from work.
I want to bring in an email from Lars, who says, a 4-day work week is essential to conducting a busy life in the 21st century, running errands, kids' needs, doctor's appointments. There are just not enough personal time or vacation days that can be taken. You talked about some of the things driving this trend, but is it possible that one of the things behind this is just a shift in how we live our lives? I mean, I don't want to imagine that people in the 1970s and 80s weren't also very busy people. But do you think there is some sort of shift in the way we live our lives day to day that might be driving this?
I think that's part of it. I think we do take on more and more because with the remote work and with everything available on your phone, you say yes to a lot more tasks than you might have otherwise. And it's harder to sequence. You know, that you're in one place and you can't be in the other place when nowadays you kind of can or try. So that's possible. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And I was going to go ahead.
Yeah. And my quick follow up to that was sort of this whole busy culture. You know, when I came into corporate America right out of school, the whole thing was look busy. You know, you'll be successful if you're always busy. And we've sort of taken this as a part of our American culture. Is that one of the things driving this, that people were just sort of like burned out?
I think, yeah, after the pandemic, I think there was this reconsideration of do I want to be busy? Do I want to look busy? And when you have this interface with remote work, you could get your work done and not have to be present mm-hmm. at all the meetings for the entire meeting and feel like you're missing out or not being as visible as you could be. We're not sure where that's going to land either with remote work, but I think that's interacted with that, right? But what we do know from other surveys and people's preferences are they like having consecutive leisure time. So
right.
It's like, if I'm going to do the shopping and schlepping. Bunching that all together is better than trying to do a little bit of that every day. And I'm going to say that one of the possible benefits of that, depending on whether you do Monday not at work or Friday not at work or even in between, a lot of people were finding if they were rushed in their leisure time, they couldn't enjoy Friday because they were fatigued. They couldn't enjoy Sunday because they're thinking about Monday morning. So they have this extended time now and maybe can do address some of these leisure activities that they can get to instead of just thinking about when they're going to get to it.
And we actually got an email from Bill who works at a company that does a 4x10 work week. Bill says, I love it. I love it packs a lot into the work week, but I love having a 3-day weekend. Flip side, caller Peter says, this is all nonsense. Mm-hmm. People need to come back to the office and work 5 days a week. How can a manufacturing company possibly do a 4-day work week without a loss of productivity? I mean, there definitely is some real skepticism out there. Can you address that specifically for that type of company?
Yes, there should be some healthy skepticism. Nobody is arguing that this model is going to work any better, you know, is transportable to every industry, including transportation for that matter. You got to be mm-hmm. behind the wheel, at least until we got autonomous vehicles. So at some point, yeah, you have to realize we're going to bump up against a wall and say that, you know, maybe a 4x10. But yeah. Speaking of the 4x10, what people are drawn to there, and probably the other listener, I would guess, is people absolutely hate commuting, right? And parking and the congestion. And so the 4x10, even though it doesn't necessarily increase productivity, especially in those last hour or two, they like it because it's one less day of getting involved with the commuting. And so that's where I think it might stick. And yes, in manufacturing or, you know, forward-facing type of services where you need to be present, at least given current technology, if you have to be present, there are still ways to get by without being present, maybe more remote, or indeed having somebody else cover.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Makes
sense.
So
it
Makes
might
sense.
Add on to some costs, but in the long run, we argue, if it is successful, as the representative said, we're just going to study it. But if it's indeed successful, if companies stick with it, it must be that they took on some additional cost to have a part-time person or temp or seasonal person in the high season or when things are busy to get all-around coverage. But it's not infeasible entirely.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Lonnie Golden, thank you so much. We appreciate you.
Appreciate you.
Yeah. Lonnie Golden is a professor of economics and labor human resources at Penn State Abington.
John Maynard Keynes predicted we'd have a 15-hour work week at some point. I want to bring you back for that conversation. Coming up on Studio 2, we're talking about teens, puberty, and social media. Stick with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manieri.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Are you there, God? It's me, Margaret. Defined a Generation with its frank discussion about puberty. And the new film is drawing major crowds. Since the book was published over 50 years ago, media has evolved and kids are now taking cues from TikTok. Producer Paige Murray Bessler talked with two students who created a relevant, relatable, and colorful book about puberty.
Puberty is a time of incredible change for everyone. It's also confusing. It always has been, but maybe made worse by misinformation about periods, self-care, sexuality, and everything in between on social media. University of Pennsylvania students Gemma Hong and Sophie Young co-wrote The Honest, Personal, and Practical Guide, Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Puberty and Shouldn't Learn on TikTok for Curious Girls. Gemma Hong, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
And Sophie, welcome to Studio 2 to you as well.
Thank you, Paige. Thank you for having us.
Gemma, I'll start with you. We know that half of TikTok creators are Gen Z. Videos with the hashtag puberty have been viewed more than 2 billion times. Why?
Puberty is such an isolating experience. Your body is changing, and sometimes you have these awkward questions that you want to ask, but you might not want to ask your mom or your dad because that might be weird. And that's why we see so many of these videos on TikTok. It's because kids are lonely and they want to talk about these issues and get advice from each other. But at the same time, it's so hard to sort of vet what information is correct, what kind of information is accurate. We sort of thought that this would be a relevant and reliable guide for girls to sort of navigate that path and get advice from older girls.
Yeah. This book is funny at zits and other indignities. You're having a growth spurt. Nobody snuck into your house and shrunk your clothes.
Yes.
Things like that. Why did you do that?
We talked about how all these adjectives used to describe puberty, weird, intimidating, awkward. But the weird and the awkward parts of it are wonderfully offset if you can joke about it. Especially, I think this is like a Gen Z thing that we do as well, is when we are hit with a lot of things that are difficult to understand, joking about them is a great way to actually normalize talking about things. This is a book where we wanted to have humor. We also wanted to be really informative and helpful. And I think the joking the more humorous aspects of it, and I'm glad that you think it's funny because that went well then, is that it's like kind of a gateway into that information. If you can feel like you're reading something that's approachable, it takes away the imposing nature of like talking about these possibly uncomfortable topics.
It's kind of like learning from your big sisters.
Yes.
If you don't have one.
It's the exact vibe that we were going for when writing this.
And there are a lot of sections of the book. One of them that most puberty books deal with is products, things to wear as you go through changes. Mm-hmm. We know about changes in menstrual products, bra styles over the decades, like older women in my family talking about wearing that belt, which I would never, ever do. But it's 2023, and we have laser hair removal. Mm-hmm. We have period panties so mm-hmm. that you can go without a tampon. Bralettes, stick-on bras. There are all of these things available now, and you talk about all of those in the book. What do you think that all of these options do to the experience of going through puberty?
I think it's awesome that we have so many more options now because, you know, everyone's bodies are different. Everyone's preferences are different. And being able to find something that suits you better than something else is great. One journey that I definitely had during puberty was figuring out period products and which ones were most comfortable for me. You know, I got the introduction to pads from my mom, but at the same time, you know, I sort of wanted to explore. I sort of wanted to, like, see what my options were. And I think having, like, all of these options, while they may be scary and, like, may be sort of different, ultimately in the end, they just help everyone, you know, go along their period journey and find what suits them best.
Because you're going from childhood to adulthood, so part of that is, Sophie, like, finding out what mm-hmm. it is that suits you and what you want.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And moving away from talking about, like, menstrual products, like hair removal products or bras mm-hmm. and things like that, it's kind of nice to know all the different possibilities for you because you don't know what works for you until you try it or until someone you know tries it.
You lay out all this information. Mm-hmm. You explain all of these topics in the book, mm-hmm. which is very useful for parents. Why do you think adults have a hard time talking to kids about what it's like to go through puberty?
It depends on, the adult's background, but generationally, I think that there was, for a long time, a lot of stigma about talking about, especially for women, talking about women's bodies. There's still that kind of thing that we have culturally that's being pushed down where it's like a taboo topic. And I think even the most, you know, like woke parents still might have an awkward time doing it because it's hard to get over all those, like, those things that have been ingrained in us culturally, societally. My mom is a journalist. She's very open, very honest, very direct, a little too direct sometimes, especially when talking about puberty. But I know that even then, like, her main source that she gave me was books, because I know that she did feel a little bit uncomfortable having those conversations, even though she knew that they were important to have. So she gave a lot of books.
Mm-hmm. Gemma, what about you?
From the perspective of the child of immigrant parents, it might be hard to figure out the language to sort of express these sorts of things. And if I decide to have these conversations with them, it wouldn't have been too difficult. But at the same time, you know, I don't really know the words for certain types of anatomy in Korean. And I don't really know the words for all the new period technologies in Korean. So sort of like bridging that gap can also be difficult for a lot of kids, especially second gen, first gen kids.
Something that makes this book different than some others that have come for previous generations or in past years is that you include sections about anger management, depression, anxiety, consent. Why include those things now?
It's a part of puberty that we don't talk about a lot. A lot of times it just gets hidden away. Like, she's just on her period. She's cranky. Or for guys, too, it's like he's just, you know, he's like a teenage boy. He's got a lot of angst. And you don't really talk about it. But those are really big feelings and emotions. Mm-hmm. And they might feel very overwhelming and isolating. And so it's really important to talk about those things, know that it's okay that they're feeling that. And then also, if they're feeling a lot of it, that it's okay to go get help. Like, I was trying to, like, talk about how these are normal feelings to have, but don't ever be, like, afraid to talk to somebody. There's, like, a mental health crisis, right? And young people, the rates of depression and anxiety are so high, suicidality is so high. And it's something that we need to talk about in order to make that difference. I mean, it starts in just having conversations.
You each wrote things I wished I'd known when I was going through puberty. Sophie, what did you write?
I spent much of puberty waiting for it to be over.
I was tired of the in-between stage of being too old to act like a child and too much of a child to be thought of as a mature adult. I wish that I would have taken more time to appreciate all I had and all I already was, instead of constantly wondering, what if? You'll never be the age you are now again, so try to embrace it. This is my section. I rushed through middle school and a lot of high school because I wanted to become a grown-up as fast as I could. I felt like being a kid was lame. I tried acting cool by avoiding childish or cringy stuff, and I thought I could be totally independent before I was fully ready to be on my own. I wish I'd known a lot of things when I was 12. I wish I'd known to spend more time with my grandparents, and I wish I'd learned a Korean recipe or two for them. And perhaps most importantly, I wish I'd known to enjoy being a kid and the growing pains that come with it.
Gemma and Sophie, thank you so much for writing this book. Gemma Hong and Sophie Young are co-writers of Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Puberty and Shouldn't Learn on TikTok for Curious Girls.
Such good advice. I wish I had followed that myself. And I got to mention that we just learned that the book has been awarded the Children's Book Council Teacher and Librarian Favorites Award. Wow. Congratulations to the authors. And that's it for us. You can head on over to whyy.org/studio2 for more.
Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, who you just heard, and Andreas Copes. Our engineer today is Adam Staniszewski from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. My name is Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
Hey, Avi. And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us.